This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Anna Polina Lee speaking about her book, Mandarin Brazil, Race, Representation, and Memory, published in 2018 by Stanford University Press. Anna Polina Lee is Assistant Professor of Luso-Brazilian Studies at Columbia University, where she researches and teaches on urbanism, migration, race, gender, literary, and cultural studies in 19th and 20th century Brazil. Reflecting the richness of the book, our conversation spans five centuries, two continents, and multiple genres ranging from novels and poetry to popular music and vaudeville theater. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to Anna Polina Lee about her book, Mandarin Brazil, Race, Representation, and Memory. Anna is assistant professor at Columbia University, where she teaches in the Department of Latin American and Iberian Cultures. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're very excited to have you. Anna, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I am, as you mentioned, currently assistant professor of Luso-Brazilian Studies at Columbia University. And people often ask me how it is that I got interested in Brazilian study and Brazilian cultures. And while my answer is often surprising, I tell people it's actually not that I became interested in it, but I was born into it. I was born in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And so for me, Brazilian culture has always been very much part of who I am and my sense of just identity. So it was very natural for me to pursue Brazilian studies in college and in my master's program at NYU, and then in the doctoral program at the University of Southern California, where I studied comparative literature. And so one of the things that really impacted my decision to do graduate studies, to go back to graduate school, was back in 2004, 2005, when I was working in northeastern Brazil during the presidency of Lula da Silva. He created a cistern program to alleviate some of the drought-stricken areas in the Northeast. So part of my work was to work with bricklayers and NGOs in water sanitation and programs. And while I was there, I was fresh out of college. I was, you know, bright-eyed and just wanted to understand better some of the conditions of rural Brazil. So I went to the Northeast. I stayed in Pernambuco for much of my work there. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to work with different communities, and a lot of the communities where I worked were actually driven by the sugar plantation economy. So many of the people who I was working with were still living on sugarcane plantations after many generations. There was one woman named Luisa who I'll never forget. She was 90 years old, and she was born and raised in this sugarcane plantation. Her mother was a slave, she told me. Brazil, just to remind everyone, abolished slavery in 1888, It was the last country in the hemisphere of Americas to abolish slavery. Happened almost at the dawn of the 20th century. So when we think about that history, it's actually incredibly present. And people who are alive now have a very direct relationship to it. It's not something that, you know, is distant. People have, you know, their parents or grandparents were directly affected by that history, and they still carry a lot of that post-memory, that kind of trauma that comes with that. And not only that, but people are still living in conditions that are very similar. So the people who are working on the sugarcane plantations, they were making about $1 a day, you know. And so in my mind, not really knowing anything about anything about that kind of history or social conditions, I decided to go back to graduate school to understand better these kinds of legacies of slavery and the way that very similar conditions continue today in the form of wage labor, but it really becomes a kind of a continuing form of that racialized labor, but in a disguised form or reconfigured form, but the structure of it is very much present today in our contemporary period. And so that was really what drove me to go back to school to pursue a degree in Brazilian studies and to better understand the various dimensions of this kind of continuing labor exploitation that exists today.
I think one of the things that is fascinating to me hearing you talk about this background is how you come to emphasize certain kinds of cultural productions and representations, especially in the book, right? Because one of the things that I think readers of the book and our listeners will be really impressed by as we talk about the book throughout this interview is just the range of different types of cultural productions, from theater to popular music to poetry to novels to illustrations. And yet, as you said, you know, when you went back to graduate school in Brazilian studies, it sounds like you began with literature. Is that right, at USC? So how do you think about this dynamic between, you know, understanding the past and the historical grounding that you need to think about the legacies of slavery versus sort of your work as a person who works on cultural studies and studies literature and theater and all these other genres?
Absolutely. I did do as you mentioned, I studied literature and cultural studies in graduate school. And I found that to be a really helpful and incredibly important way for understanding processes of racialization, which I developed significantly in the book, which explores the political and cultural memory of racialization. And so, while I was significantly impacted by my experience working in the sugar plantations and in drought relief in Brazil, I did return to do work in literary analyses. And I found that in the tools that I learned from literary theory and literary analysis have incredibly shaped the way I approach my research and the writing of the book. So it's driven by this desire to understand processes of racial formation and racialization as tied to new kinds of labor that emerged at the end of slavery and the transition to wage labor. And so I very much was very inspired by the work of Lisa Lowe and how she uses this approach of using literary analysis and theory to understanding much more abstract understandings of racialization and its dynamic and relational processes. So there it became incredibly important for me to turn to people like Paul Gilroy and Joseph Roach, who write about the Black Atlantic and the Circumatlantic, in formulating what I use in the book as a framing device, what I call circumoceanic memory, which is a framing mechanism and also a rhetorical strategy that attempts to decolonize and deconstruct through showing and connecting various modes of cultural production. And my analysis is the production of Chineseness, which becomes a way of understanding the processes of racialization that produce an idea, a consolidated idea of Chineseness in these various time periods and spaces of connected to Brazilian nation building.
Yeah, I found that concept of circumoceanic memory to be hugely helpful in tying all of these different modes of representation together. I suppose one of the other questions I want to ask as kind of a general background to the book is also your perception or impression of the state of the field as it comes to studies of Chinese racialization in the Americas. Because one of the things that you write about in the introduction is how these kinds of studies often focus on the United States or on Canada, so mostly North American histories of Sinophobia, whereas, of course, you've chosen here to focus on Brazil while acknowledging that if we think about the history of Asian migration, of course, that's predominantly a Japanese story in Brazil. So how do you think about the state of the field in terms of the history and cultural study of Chinese racialization in the Americas?
I would start by saying that when I began this project, I found it incredibly difficult to do because it was one of those projects that it was very hard to situate within any field. So it wasn't exactly Latin American, and it wasn't exactly Asian American, and it wasn't exactly US, and it wasn't exactly Chinese. So just even in that kind of difficulty of trying to write about this topic, I often faced this challenge of where do I situate the study? And that brought me to an epistemic challenge of just how we organize knowledge, you know, how really the national framework is so powerful in constructions of academic fields, and it's really difficult to go beyond that at times when I was trying to do this kind of work. And that was a constant kind of, obstacle for me. And so that's why I really took to the task of thinking of how I could challenge these constructions of East and West and North and South, which really became central to my project. And at times that was, you know, a sense of, you know, how to write from this other space that doesn't necessarily fit into the organizing frames that are very dominant in the U.S. Academy and even and in the Brazil Academy too, which is really, you know, always so centered by nation, by area studies. And so I wanted to think about how to analyze these circulations of capital, of labor, of, you know, things that are very much historical that needed a language to talk about, but that would, if I continue to look at the division, if I was to stay within my field or to pick a field, I wouldn't have been able to go beyond and see and follow the circulations. So instead I used another logic. I decided to follow the circulation of the cultural production. And in following that circulation, I could see a whole different kind of landscape that is absolutely embedded in these historical processes. And it sheds light onto a historiography of racial formation. And then from there, it became very clear to me that these different images of, you know, racialized images of the Chinese in Brazil, in Macau, in Portugal, in Cuba, in the United States, these really globally circulating images, they were very much connected and they were tied to this larger processes of trade, of travel, of commerce, of nation building. And so a whole different kind of conversation was emerged for me, a whole different kind of set of questions emerged for me when I just flipped the script in a sense of, instead of beginning from, you know, a discipline or an area, I looked at the objects and I let the visual, the sonoric, the sense of walking through a city to speak to me. And so that's when I mean that the circumoceanic for me is also a rhetorical strategy, because it became a way for me to use prose and to use what I've learned in literary analysis and literary theory to write about the complexities of these interactions through showing, you know, through creating scenes. And in creating scenes, I hope to also create conversations and dialogues. And I very much imagined this book being used in the classroom, in undergraduate and graduate classrooms, and allowing for these individual scenes to allow for conversations about the circumoceanic that, you know, instead of telling, I really wanted to show all of the different kinds of power dynamics of the different layers of imperialisms that have created racialized and ethnicized and gendered identities to come out in that kind of experience of walking through a city, the experience of reading a text with multiple languages in your head, you know, straddling multiple contact zones, and just to show that, and to have it be a dialogue, right? So a kind of a dialogic experience also in that kind of in through the writing of it.
I'm dying to talk to you about some of these different genres that you've started to name. And so I think maybe what we'll do is, I should note for listeners that there are six chapters in Mandarin Brazil. Chapter one, I think I'm actually going to skip over, even though it gives really helpful background about some of the early ideas of China that are formed via porcelain, export porcelain, and the chinoiserie trade, and also the racial hierarchies that are produced through Brazil's history of slavery. But I want to actually move us forward to chapter two, because we've started talking about some of these different ways of representing Chineseness and the ways in which those representations are useful for Brazilian national identity and national projects. And I think you begin to get into some of these genres in chapter two, which is titled Emancipation to Immigration. And in this particular chapter, it's rich with illustrations of Chineseness in journals like the Revista Ilustrada. And you will have to excuse my terrible pronunciation, which is very much inflected by my.
That was very good. That was very.
Well, it's inflected by my high school Spanish, which is embarrassing. I wondered if we could start with this first genre of representations of the Chinese. Can you situate us in the historical period in which they arise? And what do these illustrations tell us about how Brazilians understand Chineseness during this era?
Absolutely. So this is a chapter about the gradual emancipation of slavery, the end of the 19th century in Brazil, and the turn to the global pressure to end slavery, and then the turn to new kinds of labor. Because the large agriculturalist slaveholding class was not about to give up the mass, the immense sugar cane and coffee plantations that brought immense wealth to all of the people involved in leading and being the owners of these spaces. So they were not going to give that up. And so that's something that really drove the push for Chinese labor as a solution to this potential labor crisis, you know, the end of a slave labor and the need to continue that kind of labor, but in disguised form, since there was this global pressure to end slavery. So it had to be in a disguised form. And so the Chinese laborers, or, you know, the so-called coolies, as they were derogatively called, they became a possible solution to that to that time period. But at the same time, there was also a lot of other forms of immigration. You know, it wasn't just the Chinese. There were also many Europeans from Italy, Spain. There were also Middle Eastern immigrants coming from Syria, Lebanon. So there were a huge amount of immigration coming in. And at the same time, there was also a social exclusion of people who were formerly slaves or liberated or born free. So there was this complete neglect of that, you know. So people who were formerly enslaved became liberated, and then they were completely excluded from entering into society, which caused just, you know, up to today has caused this immense kind of social death and exclusion that we can continue to see. There were laws that, like the vagrant laws, that went after people who were unemployed, but people who were unemployed because nobody wanted to hire them because of their skin color or their previous, you know, enslaved condition. So there were all of these negative challenges and just kinds of obstacles that faced many people coming out of slavery. And so the Chinese were entering into this kind of landscape. And what chapter two does is, and what I tried to do in all the chapters, is to show these different layers of complexity that wasn't just, you know, the latifundium slaveholding class that wanted to continue that, but there was also the fact that there were coolie labor throughout the Americas, you know, indentured Chinese labor throughout the Americas, and the British were part of that. And then the United States, there was the gold mining, and then the question, the Chinese question that came out of that, as Mei Nai writes about, this idea of the coolie question or the Chinese question that becomes global. And so there's so many layers of trying to understand where the Chinese fit in within this emerging Brazilian national consciousness, but also these globally circulating ideas of Chineseness, and also what was happening in China, right? That was also a question for me. What did Qing officials, and how are they conceiving of this idea of Chineseness also? Because as I argued, it was really a time when the idea of Chinese was consolidating for the late Qing. For many late Qing statesmen, they started to think about China, Chinese as this race, you know, and they talk about this Chinese race, right? And what does that even mean? So they begin to think of these ideas after they visit Brazil. They go to Brazil, they see this organizing, you know, form of racial categories, of slavery, of different European immigrants. As I mentioned in one of my examples of diplomatic correspondences, Fu Yinglong, who writes about, he creates these different categories of you know, these different races in Brazil that he just creates, and he names the Chinese as a race, right? And so that is one of the first times that China begins to think of itself as in this kind of global landscape and where it's going to fit in. And so you see the circulation of racial ideologies, of nation building, and how they become globalized. They're moving around. You know, they don't have a particular origin, but what's important is that the contact is what creates them. And so they're moving, they're circulating, and they're influencing these larger ideas of nation building that become racialized, and they reconfigure colonial racial categories that determined also subjugated forms of labor, and they reimagine them within these new kinds of national categories that are also racialized in the Americas, and China develops its own idea of, you know, Chineseness that has to do with also creating a Chinese state. Right. And so that's what chapter two does. It shows these kinds of different debates happening around the construction of Chineseness and its the way it also lets us think about also this global construction of race that's happening.
As someone who works on Asian American history, I found it incredibly interesting that the I hadn't known about sort of a more systematic effort within the Qing government to investigate other places like Brazil as almost colonial spots in the same way that, you know, I understood from Ichiro Izuma's work that the Japanese government, you know, had sort of seen the North American West as a new frontier for Japan, that the Chinese were doing the same. And, you know, and as you said, you mentioned a couple of different officials. And that may be a good segue to talk about Chapter 3, because the visit of one of these officials named Tang Jingxing actually prompts theatrical portrayals of Chinese-ness in Brazil. And Chapter 3, which is titled Performing Yellow Face and Chinese Labor, you look at portrayals of Chinese-ness and Sino-Brazilian encounters in, again, excuse my butchering of Portuguese, Teatro de Revista, or review performances. So how did these work, maybe in comparison to the illustrations that appear and that you write about in Chapter 2, how are they similar and how are they different in terms of the depictions of Chinese that are presented on stage?
These performances of Yellow Faith in 19th century review theater, or vaudeville, we can also call them that, they were very much in dialogue with the images circulating in the Revista Ilustrada, which show this kind of larger abolitionist vocabulary, if you will, that was being constructed by various artists, writers, politicians. And what becomes evident here, which was not evident before, is that a lot of these major writers, you know, like Machado de Assis, these very canonical, if you will, Brazilian authors, were very much engaged in this abolitionist work. And one of the ways that they were advocating for abolition was also to say that actually Chinese labor is not a good idea if we really want abolition, because the Chinese in their writings became, yellow labor became a figuration or symbolic of new forms of precarious labor. So it wasn't so much, so there's a distinction between anti-Chinese and anti-coolie labor that comes out in their writings. So anti-Chinese wasn't always the same as anti-coolie, and coolie becomes a figuration of new forms of precarious labor that would substitute slave labor. And so sometimes this idea of anti-Chinese, it gets conflated with anti-coolie, but, you know, there's these kinds of ambiguities in the writing. And so here in performing Yellow Face and Chinese Labor, we can see a lot of these debates happening on the stage, which shows a really rich part of 19th century Rio and how theater was so present, you know, in people's lives that it became a place to deliberate citizenship. As Artur Azevedo, one of the founders of the Teatro de Revista, one of the leading writers of the genre, he, you know, thought of theater as a national institution, right? A place to deliberate citizenship. And theater goers were incredibly diverse. They were different socioeconomic levels, all you know, different kinds of, a lot of Portuguese merchants. So all, you know, walks of life were part of this theater scene as constituted part of Rio's theater public. And so the fact that they were performing these ideas was also a way of performing larger social issues, political issues. And the theater was often a place that critiqued contemporary politics. And it was a way to parody and satirize and, you know, to ridicule politicians. And so it became this very important carnivalesque space, in a way, where the social order became, you know, questioned. It became caricature. It became ways to really point a finger, you know, these critical fingers at society, but always with laughter, always, you know, with this sharp humor. And that's what I think was really appealing to about the theater. It would make these incredibly harsh observations, but always with laughter. So it kept people coming back, kept people laughing. It made people see, you know, different points of views, different debates. And so here we have examples of various examples of theater being used in this way.
I think the example that stood out most to me is your discussion of a play called O Mandarin, or the Mandarin, in 1883. And the part I want to pick up on, because I think you expand on this point later on as well, is that the way that the play depicts Chinese gender and sexuality as androgynous and as strange, and therefore unassimilable in Brazil, or undesirable at least in Brazil. This returns us back to the point of you're speaking about anti-coolie not being sometimes the same as anti-Chinese, which I think is an important distinction. In this particular case, what are some of the objections to Chinese gender and sexuality as they play out in this play called O Mandarin?
That's a really great observation. So these theater these reviews were really important also in the way that they were constructing ideas of gender and sexuality about the Chinese. And so just to contextualize it a little bit, these ideas about the Chinese in terms of gender and sexuality were very much tied to their ability as laborers and as a reproductive labor force. So the conversations about Chinese gender and sexuality are always tied to whether they will bring too many laborers, whether they will. So labor and reproduction become incredibly tied in these conversations about the construction of gender and sexuality. So will the Chinese bring too much labor, bring a labor force? They will, you know, procreate to this, you know, and create a surplus of labor. But, and then there it gets tied to a fear about this so-called yellow race, right? Because at this time, Brazil was also very invested. Many politicians were very invested in the project of racial whitening, branqueamento, which is literally called whitening. There was this predominant belief that Brazilian modernity, Brazilian modernization, liberty, everything was also tied to its racial identity, this kind of idea of creating a whitening race. So through miscegenation, Brazil could become whiter. And, you know, so it would, the idea is that it was whiter because there was just a huge population, and there was an idea that Brazil could become whiter in the likes of Europe, in the likes of these white liberal democracies, right? So the miscegenation was a critical discourse in Brazilian nation building. And here the Chinese enter into debates about miscegenation. You know, will the Chinese aid in the Brazilian whitening, racial whitening project? Well, in these plays and in the abolitionist journal, the debate is that no, they are going to actually threaten the racial whitening project. And in a few examples, they show that the Chinese will actually yellow the population. So there's this fear that they would yellow the population. And that goes back to something that Joaquim Nabuco, a leading abolitionist, said against the Chinese. He said the Chinese will not be good for Brazil because they will mongolize Brazil in the way that African slaves Africanized Brazil. So, you know, there's this very much tied idea that the Chinese were not going to be the good white liberal subjects that Brazilian politicians were hoping for. And that added to this atmosphere of Sinophobia.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And I think we'll return to that when we talk about the last chapter, because, you know, at the moment where a diasporic African identity or a mestizo nationalism becomes dominant in Brazil, you know, the question of miscegenation takes on a different significance. But before we do that, I would love to talk to you about chapters 4 and 5. And I sort of want to talk about them in tandem, because as I read them, there was a focus on literature, sort of going back to your wheelhouse, perhaps, if we can call it that. Different genres from poetry to novels a genre that I don't think I've encountered before called crónicas, which you say sit between factual news reporting and fiction. So perhaps we can just sort out the genres, and then we can maybe then get into the representations that appear. What are some of the different genres in which Brazilian writers are talking about Chineseness during the late 19th century?
Well, the Brazilian writers who I chose, they were writing across genres. Machado de Assis was incredibly prolific. He wrote pretty much, you know, every genre: poetry, theater, crónicas. He also used pseudonyms. He was an incredibly prolific writer. And Eça de Queiroz, Machado de Assis was also you know, a civil servant. So they were straddling a lot of these different positions in society as literary intellectuals, as civil servants. In the case of Eça de Queiroz, he was a diplomat. He went to, he did a lot of missions for Portugal. He was also writing about warning Brazil about accepting Chinese labor because of the risk of it becoming like the situation in Cuba, you know. And so they were writing across genres. And that's something, too, that is very common for 19th century Brazilian literature, that these writers, and were also diplomats, they were writing across genres. So it wasn't, it was very natural just to see what else they were writing in different genres. What I did find interesting was to match, for example, Machado de Assis's work in the Ministry of Agriculture and his work in upholding the free womb law in that capacity, which, you know, it's also something to think about, that these debates over liberty and freedom were being discussed in the Ministry of Agriculture, just to show that, again, that linkage between labor and reproduction, right? The gender and sexuality of the enslaved Black woman being debated in the Ministry of Agriculture. And then that same discourse gets placed onto Chinese sexuality and gender. You know, are the Chinese going to be a good reproductive and good labor force? So that gets repeated throughout these works, and it just shows a larger logic about that. But so what I did was I took the work that I looked at Machado de Assis's work as in the Ministry of Agriculture, and looked at his literary production happening at that same time to see if there was some kind of connection between what he was seeing, you know, at that time. It was also the beginning, this attempt to begin a 10-year experimental Chinese labor importation scheme. There was also that. And so what he was doing in his literary works. And I found a lot of parallels. You know, in some cases, he was extremely explicit that, you know, and very anti-Chinese making fun of the accent, making fun of the way that, you know, these stereotypes, he was circulating these stereotypes. But he was also using, you know, pseudonyms. He was also writing from the disguise of British officials. So there's this play also, you know, where is his voice? And because he disguises it in so many layers. But just matching what they were doing in their political lives, in their professional lives, as civil servants, to their work in literary production, enabled me to make these connections much clearer. You know, he wasn't just, for example, he translated a series of Judith Gautier's poems, and she was the daughter of Théophile Gautier, who is a major figure of French Orientalism. However, I show that he's not just, you know, creating a new kind of French Orientalism in Brazilian literary production. He's actually very much talking about this larger concern of Chinese labor, of the labor crisis, of political crisis. And it becomes almost impossible to read that after seeing, you know, after putting the historical context in conversation with after reading the literary works within their historical context, it becomes almost difficult not to interpret it that way. And then so looking at his other works where he makes these mentions, for example, in Memorias Póstumas de Brás Cubas, he mentions very briefly the appearance of a Chinese barber and this Mandarin who pays for his services with pinches and sweets. And so that was a scene that I read many years ago, and I always thought it was so strange that that scene was even there. It didn't really make sense to me. But it did start to make sense once I put that piece into the larger picture of what he was writing about at that time. And suddenly that became a way to, you know, part of this other conversation that he was participating in, which was tied more to concerns about what abolition and nation building actually meant and the place of these new laborers in society and what they would do for Brazil as a nation trying to make itself known on this world stage. And it was looking at Europe and at the United States as these models of white liberalism that it could follow.
I think it's important to note here for listeners that your discussion of these particular literary works really plays off of Timothy Hampton's idea of diplomatic poetics, which I was not actually familiar with. So perhaps you could just say a little bit about what that concept, how that concept is active in your analysis of these different literary works.
Timothy Hampton's, what he calls diplomatic poetics, was really helpful for me in thinking about the role that diplomats played and their works, the work between diplomacy and literature. So as I mentioned, Issa de Queiroz and a few other writers who I wrote about, they were also diplomats. And what Timothy Hampton does is he gives us a way to think about diplomatic poetics as not mere representation, but he says that diplomacy's authority is shaped by representation, whereby diplomatic authority is mere representation, and where representation must claim whatever authority it can garner through negotiation instead of violence. And so the aim of diplomatic poetics is to mediate, negotiate, and arbitrate an alternative to the escalation of violence by prioritizing the function of representation. And so representation here becomes political, and the political can also become representation. And there's this very fantastic tension that Timothy Hampton creates for thinking about these, you know, political historical texts and aesthetic texts and their relationship to each other. So when we look at Issa de Queiroz's diplomatic works in conjunction with his literary works, there's so much overlap in the way that he writes about the Mandarin, for example, and the coolie, for example. So Issa de Queiroz was a diplomat, and he went to Cuba to assess the situation of the Chinese contract laborers who arrived there. And, you know, it's important to note that not all Chinese laborers were coolies, right? They were not all indentured servants. There were different conditions, and they had different statuses, and so that kind of all becomes homogenized in the concept of the coolie. But so he went to Cuba, and there he saw what was happening, and he went actually with this proposal for Portugal to say that the Chinese coming from Macau were actually Portuguese. He, you know, tried to do that, but it didn't work because the Chinese claimed they were Chinese, and Spain, Cuba was also not accepting of that proposal, of that claim. So his mission there was pretty futile, and he understood that. But nevertheless, he wrote about the Chinese, and he wrote about the negative effects of Chinese and Japanese also immigration would have. He wrote about the negative effects that Chinese and Japanese immigration would have in Brazil, and he published his works in Brazilian in Rio, you know, Carioca, which is from Rio, newspapers. So he was very much in conversation with people in Brazil, and again, showing the circulation of ideas, right? So he was saying that he just saw what happened in Cuba, and he rejects, and he urges the Brazilian public to reject that possibility for Brazil. And you can see in his works that he was very much invested in this idea of this kind of superiority of, you know, of a Portuguese and this European superiority, and it was very much embedded in his work. But his point of view also shifts in different works, and that's something that is interesting about him, because his perspective changes, and his literature is not consistent. He has different viewpoints, and Machado de Assis also does this. You know, they show these conflicting, ambiguous viewpoints. It's very hard to pinpoint an exact position of them, but they do this work of showing these different instances, different viewpoints. And so if you look at different moments of his writing, he's showing these different positions, you know, and sometimes he's writing from the perspective of this diplomatic poetics, and sometimes he's writing from this more literary orientalist depiction. But so that idea of diplomatic poetics was very important for me to help me think about these intersections between historical, political, and aesthetic texts.
Yeah, I see that tension being very productive. I suppose one more sort of diplomat author that I want to just flag for listeners, and perhaps you can speak a little bit about, is Luis Guimarães Filho, if I'm pronouncing that relatively accurately. But his book, you write about a book called, and I'm loosely translating based on my understanding of Portuguese, Samurais and Mandarins, which was published in 1912. Which was actually a collection of travel writing. He had been a diplomat, eventually became the Brazilian ambassador to Madrid and to the Vatican. But what I find interesting about this, because of, you know, some of the references we've made to earlier in our conversation to Japanese migration, is how somebody like Guimarães Filho looks at portrayals of Japanese-ness versus Chinese-ness, and how he thinks about inverting existing or preconceived notions of Orientalism and sort of playing with what people expect that they know about Japan and Japanese people versus China and Chinese people. So in this particular case, can you talk a little bit about how China compares to Japan and what somebody like Guimarães Filho is trying to do through his diplomatic poetics of these two countries in comparison?
So one of the things I found interesting between Guimarães Filho and Eça de Queiroz's writings about China and Japan is that they both do this rhetorical strategy of saying to their reader, all you know about the Orient is based on these fictional Orientalist writings, you know, and they actually talking about Orientalism, this literary Orientalism that has created an imaginary of the Orient that dominates their readers' understanding of places like China and Japan. And so both of them, A.C.H. Queiroz and Guimarães Filho, they're telling their reader this kind of, you know, what you know about China and Japan is all based on these literary works that have constructed an idea of this exotic, imagined, you know, nice, distant place where, you know, all of those kinds of stereotypes. But so A.C.H. Queiroz then does this rhetorical shift, this strategy of saying, this is what you know, but actually, and then he goes into this sense, he begins this yellow peril discourse of actually you have to, you know, there's this fear, you know, he creates this other kind of fear that the Orientalist imaginary has disguised what he then starts talking about as this Chinese labor, as Japanese imperialism, really, you know, he begins this new kind of racialization of the Chinese and Japanese in within yellow peril discourses. And so that is a shift in his tone and in also in the historiography of racialization. There's this, you know, turn that he's doing. And Guimarães Filho, he does something similar. He says to his predominantly, you know, female reader, upper middle class, he imagines she's sitting in her, you know, room and just reading these tales of the Orient and delighting in all of their kind of exotic, you know, descriptions. And he also says that it's very important to debunk that. So his mode of diplomatic poetics, he begins to debunk these Orientalist, Portuguese Orientalist depictions of China. And he specifically goes to earlier works, 16th century works of, for example, Fernão Mendes, who wrote Peregrinações. And his tales of this, you know, Portuguese voyagers throughout Asia, throughout places like Macau and Goa and all over. And he says, actually, those were all false when he goes, because he goes to China, he says, there's this imaginary of China that I had doesn't exist, you know. And then he also does this work of debunking these Orientalist representations of China. And there, instead, he again does the switch to more of this yellow peril discourse of the Chinese. You know, he uses the Boxer Rebellion as a way to paint the Chinese as this very rebellious, you know, peasant class. And he does that work. And so in his diplomatic poetics, he sees Japanese immigration as a good thing. And so he does this turn from Chinese to advocating for Japanese immigration and saying the Japanese are, they offer something. Japanese immigration, in his view, is much more favorable, although he does write about this rising Japanese empire, this powerful Japanese empire, and, you know, these different kinds of power dynamics there. But he sees that as a positive thing that could be positive for Brazil. And so they're doing different things with their literature. They're shifting ideas about the Chinese and the Japanese, but then they're creating new ideas, new racial representations about them for different specific goals of whether it be migration, whether it be aligning with, you know, Japan as a superpower, etc.
I think the point you made about how Guimarães Filho works with the Boxer Rebellion or the Boxer Uprising is fascinating to me, because just it sort of points to the way in which the Chinese just can't win, right? In terms of representation, you know, if they're workers, you know, they're sort of too passive. They'll overwhelm, you know, Brazil as these overly productive workers. If they're taking up arms, then they're too aggressive, and they become a threat in terms of how they might rebel and carry out similar attacks in Brazil if they come to Brazil. And it just sort of captures perfectly this problematic position for the Chinese in representation. Which I guess now we'll zoom forward to the 1930s and 1940s Brazil. We're now in the period of World War II, and this is the subject of the final chapter of the book. And the chapter's title is "The Yellow Peril in Brazilian Popular Music." So here we're also shifting again to a different mode of cultural representation to musical forms. And to me, this was a fascinating chapter. Because again of my own background in knowing what happens to U.S. Sinophobia and anti-Chinese representations during the context of World War II, which turned dramatically positive from what they had been, you know, even just several decades before, because of this alliance that is developed between China and the United States. Brazil is also, I understand, you know, part of that alliance at least after 1942, but. It seems, at least based on your analysis of popular music, that in terms of Chinese gender and sexuality again, but also in terms of Chinese economic competition, that the representations don't go through as dramatic of a shift from negative to positive. Would that be a fair representation or characterization?
Absolutely. And going back to what you just said, that you know there's this cultural kind of exclusion of the Chinese and you just can't win, right, in these representations. And again, there's this sense that, as you said, there is a shift to a more positive view of the Chinese because of Brazil's alliance with the Allied powers in World War II. And here you also see a shift, whereas the Japanese immigrants were previously seen as a good like a good solution. There's a shift there, and it very much is aligned to the Japan's role with the Axis. And so there's that, you know, very clear shift. However, what's interesting is that the Chinese, they're still not completely, the representations are not always positive. They're still economically in economic competition. They're still not trustworthy when it comes to economics. And this, again, these ideas that the Chinese are not trustworthy, that Chinese are in economic competition, that the gender and sexuality again is repeated, you know, the Chinese masculinity and Chinese is emasculated, it's not trustworthy. You know, there's always these similar kinds of ideas about Chinese gender and sexuality that were present throughout in earlier constructions from the 19th century, and they continue through these songs. But then there's this sense that there's a construction, this global construction of Chinese gender and sexuality, but then also another layer of how the Chinese get constructed within Brazilian culture and Brazilian understandings of gender and sexuality. And this very Brazilian figure of the mulata, which is a figure who comes, you know, develops directly out of the violence of the plantation. The mulata is a mixed race woman, hypersexualized, and she signals the violence of plantation, you know, sexual violence from the plantation. But then she becomes this very, you know, erotic symbol and a symbol of mixed race, of mestizaging, of mixed raceness. And so and gets appropriated in carnival, gets appropriated and re-signified. So this is also a fascinating figure that contains all of these different layers of history, you know, of this violent history of re-signification and reclaiming of that history and taking back. So today it's not, you know, in carnival, mulata is a stock figure of carnival. There's mulata, and anyone can dance mulata as long as you can do the samba moves. You know, you have to be highly trained. It's a very difficult role, but it's a role in carnival. So it's very embedded in Brazilian culture, Brazilian cultural heritage and identity, but this figure carries that legacy. And so Chinese female sexuality and Japanese gain meaning according to this understanding. And it's kind of this patriarchal structure of the plantation that takes new form in the urban, in urban gender, right? Constructions of urban gender. And you can still see how these ideas are there, but they're reconfigured in these new spaces and new bodies.
I want to maybe end our discussion on a more recent note, because one of the most sort of striking sections of this chapter on popular music is your discussion of a pop singer who in 2004 in Brazil released a children's album, the included in that album with a music video is an old carnival marcha song from 1936, the title which is Lig 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 Lay, written by Santiago Oswaldo and Paulo Barbosa. And apparently you write that in the music video, you know, at various points when she sings different lines, she actually sort of pulls back her eyes to make them look squinty and slanted, which is most of our listeners I think will know is sort of a caricature and often used to deride Chinese people. So how do you? I know you've been in Brazil recently for field work, but probably for other reasons as well. How do these representations look today? And what do you see? And you know, is there any effort to push back on? I mean, this is only a decade ago, as recently as 2004. How do people respond to these images today, especially given the rise of China in the world?
Well, I would say those images today, that kind of gesture is still very dominant. And recently there was a controversy that a soap opera hired a white actor to play an Asian character, and they, also did a kind of yellow face on the actor, and didn't think there was anything wrong with that. So there's this idea that, it's a mode of Brazilian racism that is very much masked within the idea of racial democracy. So the idea of racial democracy is incredibly violent, because then all of these very racially charged and racist gestures can slip through, and people can say, "Oh, I wasn't being racist." I'm not racist, but the gesture already happened. The subjugation already happened through that gesture. This assertion of a kind of dominance already happened through that gesture. And even if you try to say that it wasn't intentional, the act already happened. So there's this constant sense of that's how, Brazilian racism works. There's this negation that there's racism, and then there's this assertion of that racial dominance, of a social dominance that's always told, reiterated through these colonial racial ideologies and replicated again and again and again. And then a kind of denial of it. There's this pattern of how that happens. And here you see the same thing. You see this singer who is making the squinty eye gesture, and it's for a children's show, a children's program. So most likely, she's influencing young minds, and they're going to think that gesture is normal and replicate it. And so even though they're not conscious that they're doing this assertion, they're nevertheless asserting a kind of power dynamic and racial dominance again and again and again. And here's, one example, but there's many, many other ones that happen in the society, and sometimes they're microaggressions and sometimes they're macro, but it's a very much part of Brazilian racism to have these sorts of very racist gestures, but masked behind you know, other discourses of disguise that, oh, we're a racial democracy, we're all mixed race, we all have, you know, mixed race ancestry, different ancestors, but it's still undeniable that racial hierarchy exists. It's undeniable that there's a genocide of predominantly Black men in this country. And so there are these, you know, very clear material and violent consequences that come out of these very micro and not so micro macro gestures. And we see how cultural production really is complicit with these dynamics of power and race.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for writing an ambitious and rich book that shows the context, historical and cultural, for these representations. You know, we've sort of gone from the 16th century to the early 20th century, and we've looked at everything from illustrations to poetry to novels to vaudeville theater to popular music. And I hope listeners will appreciate the richness of that, of these different archives of Chineseness and Chinese representation in Brazil. And I wonder if we could end by having you talk a little bit about what you're working on at the moment. I know you are speaking to us from Brazil. Do you have a project that you are currently working on?
Yes, actually, I'm working on two projects right now that I'm very excited about. One has to do with a working group that I co-direct with my colleague Anupama Rao called Geographies of Injustice, where we study different kinds of housing inequality in different places around the world, like Mumbai, Rio de Janeiro, and we're in Harlem. And so I've been working with a local museum here based in Rocinha, which is known often as the largest favela in Latin America. And so the work with the museum directors, they've been doing this beautiful memory and history project of mapping the history of Rocinha over the last 100 years through oral history, through photography, through songs, to show the rich layers of Brazilian history that are present in this space. And through these oral histories, we've come to see different histories of migration, of settlement. We've come to see how the drugs and arms trafficking business has affected this community, this space. And so by doing this, they're showing this much larger picture of Brazilian history that often gets invisibilized, I would say purposefully, in order to, you know, continue these very kinds of violent economic trade, right? Because the arms trade, the drug trade are incredibly lucrative businesses, and they often take place in these spaces, and they become authoritarian forms of dominating the lives of predominantly working class people who occupy, who live in these spaces. And you know, and this is a huge population. We're talking about almost one in four people in Rio live in a self-housing situation, right, where they've built their own homes in land that they've claimed. And so that's one project I'm working on. And the other one I'm working on now is about the persecution of African diasporic religions in Rio. So I've been studying these earlier 20th century history of religious persecution, predominantly directed at religions of African origin, and looking at laws and cases of people who were affected by this. And so that's something that is just a new project I'm starting on. I'm also really excited about that. And so that's what I've been doing here these last few months.
Well, that sounds like great projects. And I hope that they more than anything else, keep you warm during as we enter the winter here in North America. But Anna, I want to say thank you for sharing your time with us, sharing your ideas and your research with us on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm sure our listeners did as well. So thank you again.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation as well.
That was my conversation with Anna Paulina Lee, author of Mandarin Brazil, Race, Representation, and Memory, published in 2018 by Stanford University Press. My name is Ian Shin, and this is New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.